Hey everyone, and welcome to Chef AJ Live. I'm your host, Chef AJ, and this is where I introduce you to amazing people like you who are doing great things in the world that I think you should know about. Well, today is my 64th birthday, and who better to celebrate it with the co-authors of the book, The Pleasure Trap. I think they've come on my show in the last 4 years since I've been doing the show for my birthday, and today they're going to talk about the hidden force that underlies your health and your happiness. Please welcome Dr. Alan Goldhammer and Dr. Doug Lyle. Thank you, gentlemen, for spending part of my birthday with me. I really appreciate it.
Happy birthday, AJ.
Well, thank you. You know, it's interesting because you say the hidden force, but is it really hidden?
Yeah. The whole damn world of psychology doesn't even know it's there. The hidden force is the instincts in you that are essentially responding to automated value systems that are in your sensory system or actually in your higher order ability to run cost benefit analysis. So you can be addicted to gambling for exactly the same reason that you're addicted to, you know, sugar, fat, salt, which is that gambling is an attempt to get resources out of exchanges. And so if you could get a super normal feedback out of an exchange, then that would be potentially addicting. So yeah, the force is hidden because the force is basically understood by almost nobody. I mean, there are a few people that understand it, but very few people understand it, particularly the people themselves. So this is why, you know, multitudes of analysis on the pleasure trap, if you read we didn't even write some of the words that describe the pleasure trap and on the book jacket. That was written by a consultant that actually read our book, and I forget her name. She's quite a dynamic character, but she basically, the message that she pulled out of it was, hey, the reason why people are in trouble isn't because, you know, there's something wrong with them. It's because they've been trapped. Okay. And so basically what we're saying is that quit looking for psychodynamic childhood traumatic or other reasons why it is. This is what I call the mysterious motivation. Why is it that I just can't? Why is it? It's like, yeah, well, I've been hearing that, you know, for the 20 years since we published this book. Why is it that I just can't seem to? Well, we explain why it is that you just can't seem to. It's because your environment is pathological, not you. And until you get it extremely clear that it is the environment that is pathological, not you, you know, you're going to keep missing the hidden force. So the hidden force is the motivational force that takes place as a dynamic between, in this case, a pathological environment and the native neural circuits to the organism that tell it what it ought to be doing. So if you follow your instincts in a pathological environment, you have a disaster on your hands, which is the health state of the average American.
You know, and a good example of this is really the situation people face with obesity. For 100,000 years, there's been modern humans on the planet. And for 99,800 of that year, obesity was a rare thing. You know, the people that got obese then got the same diseases we get now, heart disease and cancer and diabetes. The problem were they were called kings, because it was only very few people that could consistently overeat or get access to the highly concentrated foods that would allow them to achieve and maintain obesity. Just like in nature, there's very few instances where you'll see obese animals. Even whales, who are, you know, you think of as fat, they're not fat at all. They're 9% body fat. They're lean, mean machines. They happen to wear their adipose tissue on the outside of their body. But there's no obesity in nature unless they get exposed to the pleasure trap. And then they get the same problems we do, and they get the same diseases, kind of diseases we do. And it's not because of psychological reasons. It's not mommy not loving them or daddy loving them too much, or it's not because they have stress from going to work. It's biological. They fool the satiety mechanism of the brain with this hidden force that undermines their ability to regulate their appropriate dietary intake. It works in humans, it works in rats, it works in birds, it works in everybody and everything. And so, yeah, is it hidden? Yeah. Why do you think 3/4 of people are now overweight or obese and they're busy out there looking for every possible explanation except the one that's actually accurate?
You know, excuse me, Dr. Lyle, because, you know, it's funny, you had mentioned the cover.
Yeah.
And one of the questions was, because I didn't quite understand the cover, but the words that are there are coffee, drugs, tobacco, alcohol, sex, and medications. But there's no reference to food. And you did say that for some people, sugar, fat, and salt is an addictive process.
Well, anything's super normal. So the correct way to think about addiction is to think about it on a continuum. So that ultimately what's happening in all motivation, which when we say all motivation, that's going to include every animal down to a mosquito. Okay, so trees don't have motives. They don't have brains. So they're not running calculus and they're not moving in order to reorient themselves relative to their environment. They do have automated mechanisms for essentially making decisions about whether to put out new growth or not put out new growth or put out more roots, et cetera. And they're responsive to environmental inputs that actually alter their growth patterns. But that's not the same thing as movement. So time-lapse photography that shows some plant, you know, climbing up a rail in order to get to the sun, but that is not movement. That's growth. That's something different. But animal behavior is fundamentally different than plants. So animals have brains. So animals move, okay? And they don't move randomly. They move with a purpose. The purpose is to obtain or secure resources that are improving the statistical likelihood of survival or reproductive success. So that is why animals move. Doesn't look like it when your cat curls up and lounges and goes to sleep. You're like, well, what is it doing? Answer, it's about sleeping, so it's restoring its brain cleanliness and function. It's resting its body. It's also, if it's a little bit cold, it may curl up in order to actually conserve a little bit of energy. And if it's really warm, you'll find them lounge out on the carpet because they don't need to be in that space. They'll actually be in a different posture. So when you look at all movements have underneath of them decisions. And under those decisions, there's cost-benefit analysis. And under the cost-benefit analysis, there's pre-programmed mechanisms for evaluating the value of environmental opportunities and threats. And so the pleasure trap is when human beings have artificially changed the environment. And so to the extent that you artificially change the environment, you're going to alter the calculus that people are going to do. Now, some changes in the environment are not going to be, quote, pleasure traps. So if you build a really pretty home on a river and a person says, gee, I'd really rather be in there than camping by that river, that's an artificial set of circumstances that has improved matters for humanity, okay? But when you start talking about some other possible values that can be concentrated, so there's values inside that house, temperature regulation, freedom from predators, freedom from bugs. In other words, there's a bunch of advantages that make, quote, that house valuable. We can break those down and actually list what they are, including showing off to our friends how cool our house is. There's a whole bunch of things that are advantages in there. All of them are directly related to some kind of improvement over the sensory inputs that go into that organism that say that this is a good thing for me to be working for and a good set of circumstances for me to be in. However, those very same sensory experiences, that what life is just one series of sensory experiences after the next. So some of those sensory experiences can be intensified in a way that will alter the cost-benefit analysis of the organism in order to do what it's actually in its best interest. That is incredibly dangerous. So it goes from a mild problem like bubblegum, which is absolutely potentially, quote, addictive. In other words, is it going to be difficult for a person to get stop doing it even if they find out it's not in their best interest? The answer is yes. Why? Because it's a supernormal stimulus. Okay, then we're going to go all the way to heroin and methamphetamine, just absolutely life-destroying, intensified pleasure experiences, sensory experiences. So everything is in between. Sugar, fat, and salt are down there on the low end of the intensity, but they're enough to trap the whole damn human race. So they're not going to kill people. People aren't going to be keeling over from heart attacks at 26 years old. That isn't going to happen. But they'll be in incredibly poor shape for the vast majority of their existences because they are there's a hidden force that's undermining their health. And when you undermine your health, you undermine your happiness because your health is an enormously important feature in your overall well-being.
Was there anything back in the day that was anything like the pleasure trap back in the Stone Age, or is this a relatively new phenomenon?
No, there's absolutely nothing in the Stone Age that was like this. So this is now, I have to tell you, AJ, it's run itself. You're looking at all the way to Zuckerberg's Meta, who's going to try to put you in a room with a bunch of eyeglasses on and then some chemo computer that can put stuff in your nose. I mean, you're looking at the Matrix. It's a fiasco. But it's with digital media now drawing in people back basically in what I call the spin. Like they can't get out of it because they're so attached to digital media. It's just pulling their eyeballs towards essential sensory experiences over and over and over again. You know, this is, you know, Thomas Edison's lament of his life was that when he or his engineers, of course, invented the record player. And when they did, Edison was delighted. And he was like, this is fantastic. This is going to revolutionize education. It did nothing of the kind. So 80 years later, you get good, great courses on tape, sold a few copies. Like nobody gives a damn. Okay? It immediately became apparent, and he was unhappy about this, that, oh no, it's all going to music. That's what humanity is going to do with this invention. And he's like, what an incredible waste. And it's the same way with our incredible manufacturing capabilities and abilities to lift burdens off of people's backs in the world. It's like, wow, humanity, you know, you could live an incredibly great life. And the beautiful thing is, an individual, you can. But when you look at humanity writ large, not a chance, man. They took the opportunity that is given available to us, and they just washed it. They're going to wash their hours and their bodies right down the drain behind supernormal stimuli. And it's like, it's not their fault. They've been trapped. And that's what our book was about.
Do you have anything to add to that, Dr. Goldhammer?
What he said.
Oh, well then, okay. Is
I'll run out of steam pretty soon, but you just have.
Well, the thing I wanted to mention, AJ, was that, you know, today I get a little bit frustrated because people look at things like obesity and they treat it as if it's a cosmetic problem. That the stress is that, well, because you're bigger, you have to wear different clothes and it alters your fashion statement or something. And that's the extent of the problem. And so that people get caught in the dietary pleasure trap, the inevitable consequence of it is obesity. The problem is, not only is it a cosmetic issue, but it's also a very, very important health issue, because part of that fat is visceral fat. And that visceral fat basically functions like a tumor in the body. And it produces inflammatory products that leads to specific diseases like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, autoimmune diseases that are sucking the quality and the quantity of people's lives out of them. And because they're thinking, well, I just need to love myself the way that I am and accept the way that it is, and everybody's overweight, there's nothing that can be done with it, you just have to kind of accept your lot. Now the problem is they're ultimately accepting not just the superficial cosmetic effects and the devastating effects that that can have, but also these overwhelming health consequences that are now accepted as the norm. And that it's not even worth talking about. It's not even politically correct to talk about it. To actually tell somebody, oh, you have these diseases that are intimately tied with how many pounds of visceral fat that you have on your body, is considered a inappropriate or socially inappropriate kind of thing to do. And so to me, it's just compounding the insidious nature of the pleasure trap with this overriding social nonsense that's basically dooming people, because they aren't even given an opportunity to recognize that there's something they could actually do about it if they could figure out a strategy to escape the dietary pleasure trap, which, you know, granted, is very, very difficult, but at least it's possible. And we were able to prove that it is possible recently in a study that we did, where we actually took 29 people with high blood pressure and showed that they normalized their blood pressure with fasting and diet. And at 6 weeks, when we flew them back, we were able to show that they were able to sustain the dietary change at least for 6 weeks, and were able to, as a consequence, maintain weight loss in a drug-free and blood pressure state. And then Dr. Lyle and I had a chance to make a little wager, because we said, what percentage of these people do we think a year later, without ongoing support — there was, you know, study was over — but if we tracked those people down, would any of them be able to keep their weight and their blood pressure and their drug-free state? And Doug's pointed out that, you know, in the medical literature, about 5% of people are able to make lifestyle changes. You know, there's pretty good evidence that 1 in 20 people can do that. But that most people don't do that. Most of the evidence, when you look at most studies at trying to make behavioral change, they fail. Whatever it is, whether it's quitting smoking or quitting drinking or changing diets or losing weight or anything. And I said that our people were special, and that I thought a third of them would be able to be successful with that. Well, it turns out of the follow-up group, 75% had maintained their weight loss and maintained enough improvement that they didn't have to go back on drugs for blood pressure. Now, they weren't all 100% compliant. In fact, many of them weren't as compliant as I'd like them to be, but they were good enough that they kept their weight off, and the consequence was they had normal blood pressure without drugs. That was 75%. That was more than twice as much as I thought was going to happen. And so I was wrong. But Dr. Lyle was more wrong. And so I win. Now, in fairness, he's going to tell you right now, he was talking about the, you know, population as a whole, you know, the normal population. And our people are highly self-selected, pre-selected, more motivated, et cetera. But in fairness, when we made the bet, who do you think we were going to recruit for this study? We weren't like dragging them off the street. Of course it was going to be our self-selected people. So I still claim I win that bet.
That's good. It's reminiscent of Dean Ornish, you know, saying, I'm not here to do what's practical. I'm here to show what's possible. And yes. And that's all grand. Good job, Alan.
Now the next step would be, is if we did provide ongoing support, phone coaching, additional, you know, ease of reduced channel factors by getting companies that we have now that will offer SOS free food, et cetera, ongoing educational support where they participate in groups like what AJ does with, you know, that social emotional support stuff.
Yeah.
Would that improve adherence and compliance even more? That's my question to you.
Well, I think the answer is the most important part of the question is going to be who it is that's going to be selecting. If you take a random bunch of people out of the population that wants to lose weight, your odds of being successful, you'll be successful with 2% of the people.
So, you know, we've talked about trying to identify characteristics, personality characteristics that might predict adherence. And we looked at conscientiousness, mm-hmm. and we didn't find in that particular study that seeming like that was in and of itself very predictive. Yeah. So the real issue is going to be, how can we do a better job of identifying people that are likely to be successful versus those that are going to struggle because the pleasure trap is so overwhelming, they just can't escape it.
Yeah, what I've said on AJ's show a bunch of times is that, and it wasn't meant to cleverly, you know, basically defend any of my thinking, it's just what I said, which is that this is such a difficult problem. It takes unusual personality and unusual motivation. Mm-hmm. So it takes both. Okay. So you could be highly motivated, but you don't have the personality characteristics to pull it off.
Right.
And you could have a great deal of conscientiousness. You may have the personality to pull it off, but you're just not that motivated. So it takes a combination of those two things. That's probably why that and also probably a third variable that's actually significant that's in there that I'm not saying is that the person's life circumstances, you know, are interacting with that. So mm-hmm. if you are sufficiently disagreeable and motivated, those may not matter that much. You know what I mean? You're going to just railroad this down through everybody that's around you, and you're going to bite back at anybody that tries to stop you. So such individuals exist in the world. And then those individuals are occasionally highly motivated to pursue this. However, the fact that the people that you did have that were successful, that we couldn't pick up any personality characteristics, tells me, well, if personality is not the deciding factor, and it has to be other things, and it has to be either their life circumstance, combination of life circumstances, i.e. the ease of process as well, and that there's also personality starts being subdivided in the concept that conscientiousness, people are not equally conscientious about brushing their teeth and changing the oil in their car. In other words, it's a heterogeneous process.
Wow.
And so some people are willing to put in significant energy in the kitchen, and some people are not. Okay, that's a individual natural variable between individuals. So that's something that would take place.
So you're saying that somebody might be highly conscientious, but in specific areas. Like I find that hard to imagine. Like if you're diligent about changing your oil on time, and you know, but you would be a slob about something else. I hadn't even considered that, because your conscientiousness in the personality profile doesn't differentiate.
Right.
So we might have to have a more sophisticated screening to determine who's conscientious in regard to dietary lifestyle issues.
Yes, that's correct. That is actually what that would be. Because somebody could be incredibly conscientious over their finances or their architecture firm, all kinds of, you know, how it is they do that. But actually have we knew somebody. The dentist that was an outstanding dentist that you had referred me to, that we won't use his name here.
Right.
The point is that man was phenomenally conscientious.
Good point,
he
though.
He was absolutely self-indulgent as hell.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, AJ,
yeah.
Do you change your oil on time?
Oh, yeah, I do. I'm very conscientious.
Are there any areas, Doug, where you know me not to be conscientious?
Yes. They're being worried about the waitress's feelings.
What's interesting, though, is because of my concern about my wife's feelings,
right,
I've overridden that concern.
Barely. And I'm telling you, you barely get to the middle of the bell curve.
Okay. So, AJ, are there any areas where you're not hyper-conscientious?
I would say it's only if I really don't care about something.
Right. Well, that's the question. What do you not care enough about that you wouldn't be, you'd be comfortable being unconscientious?
Checking my email. There's like 700 and I hate doing it.
See, I would have trouble with that.
I will get to it, but I go through periods where I get overwhelmed. But in general, I think my conscientiousness pretty much translates to almost every area, unless I really just don't care.
Yeah. Just to give you all 3 minutes of understanding on personality. Okay. So what's causing personality is gene variances. And what the genes are is they're just coding for the little differences in neurotransmitter production and release and sensitivity. Okay. So there is no such thing as, quote, I got an 88th percentile squirt of conscientiousness. Okay. That's not what you have. What you have is trillions of neurological connections and an immeasurable amount of little tiny units of neurotransmitters that are going through all these different circuits. Okay. So what you're looking at is that the brain is highly heterogeneous. Every tiny little cubic centimeter of that thing is doing something different than 1 inch away in what's happening there. So what we can see, though, is genetically, you're going to find that the cost-benefit analysis of alternative courses of action in is going to have patterns the way a given machine is set up. So for example, the extroversion. Okay, so it's going to be the case that if we watch that person over time, there's all of these different kinds of social situations. And if you watch inside their head, if you had a PET scan, you could actually see an attraction versus repulsion like calculation that goes on inside their head with respect to every possible social interaction that that person faces. Okay. And you could have that person essentially facing an almost identical set of circumstances that someone else faces. And our guy is quite a bit more positive than another guy. Okay. So you watch those two brains, but you wouldn't know that actually our guy is attracted to joining a little group when there's, you know, six or fewer people in that little group. But if there's 15 people in the group, he's intimidated and he's not going to do it. Okay. The other guy, for example, doesn't want to join any group. That's an introvert. Okay. He's looking for a single individual that he already knows at that party. He's going to corner that person off into a corner and they're going to have a one-on-one conversation. So those two nervous systems are built differently, but someone else who's extroverted is going to have a different kind of subtle patterns are going to, even though they both score on a checklist at the 77th percentile, those are not the same two people.
Got it.
They're actually quite a bit different. Okay. So you can't say, oh, that person's 99th percentile conscientiousness, they're going to be able to translate this into action. Not even close. It would be a factor. It's amazing. I have an issue that probably the people that would have been interested enough to come to True North and fast, et cetera, have enough general conscientiousness that at that point, that measurement starts to not be very worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I also have a problem with the way that's measured. A lot of extremely high conscientious people will actually score at the 50th percentile or lower on a conscientiousness scale because they're so damn conscientious about how they're reading the questions. Mm-hmm. Do you ever, do you always? Well, not always. I don't always do it right.
Right.
Okay. And so there's noise in the calculation mm-hmm. of that characteristic.
So basically you didn't give me adequate filtration devices and you need to come up with a better filtration device that'll actually work because the limitations of your neuropsych testing and stuff are just kind of pitiful.
Well, yeah, particularly, I think that we tripped on something today, which is that if you did a conscientiousness about health, which is now walking your way into motivation, you know what I'm saying? So in other words, it starts to blur the lines as to what it is that we're actually talking about. But I think those are actually two separate things. So a person's motivation needs to be unusually high, but their conscientiousness in and around health, you know, health or health related behaviors, et cetera, that also needs to be high. So those two things need to be together for people to fight the trap.
Right. So basically, you should have known that before we did the last study, so we would have had a more sophisticated portfolio of questions, and then we might have gotten a decent answer.
You see what I've been putting up with for 50 years, AJ.
Oh, well, speaking of 50 years, if you don't mind, I want to just share my screen and show you. I don't know how I even got this photo. This is really interesting. I know Dr. Lyle won't believe any of the things I think. Sure. That are not like more metaphysical. However, yeah. It's really weird that today is my 1968th show and you guys met in 1968, correct? So I just want to know, do you recognize this photo at all?
Yeah,
I recognize that photo.
Here's me and Doug.
Yeah.
And John, a gentleman, it was all three of us, interestingly enough, had the top grades, but we also were all on the basketball team.
That's mm-hmm. true.
You're holding some trophies.
Yes. So that's a little bit disgusting, by the way, the whole story. Also,
should I tell this story?
Yeah, you can go right ahead, Alan.
Okay, so Dr. Lyle, when we were in school, took all like the hard classes, you know, the trigonometry and all this stuff. And I tried to focus on the ones that wouldn't take as much time or effort. But we both had one class in common, which was an art class. And he, as you know, everything he does, he turned in a very nice project carefully. I think it was a little building he designed and built, whatever it was. I forgot to do my main project. And so I was walking in and I saw he had this very nice project that he was turning in. And I pulled something out of the trash can, that was somebody had spilled some paint on a piece of paper, whatever. But I thought I'd turn something in because I didn't want to fail the class, you know. So I got this drippy, messy thing, and I turned that in as my art project. And I called it junk art, that I had recycled stuff. You know, I was being environmentally correct. Anyway, since, you know, at the end of the, towards the end of the term, they picked your best project and they hung it up at a local car wash. Well, since I had only turned in that one project, that was the project that got selected. And they put it up on the wall at the car wash. And the guy that owned the car wash didn't like it on the wall because it was kind of a piece of junk. And so he bought it, I think, for 50 cents to get it off the wall. Okay. Now come the end of the year, we both get Bs in art. Because, you know, everybody gets a B, right? Unless you're really good. Well, I took offense and I went to the teacher, Mrs. Nichols, remember her? And I said, you know, all of my art has sold. My public has spoken. Who are you to judge my art quality when I've got 100% success? And she agreed and changed my grade to an A. Well, it turned out that that one grade difference was enough to give me a half a point extra point on the grade point average. And so I beat Doug and got the valedictorian because I got the A in art and he got the B. And of course he had A's in all his other fancy classes and I had A's in all my other easy classes. We won't really talk about that because they don't grade the quality of the class you're taking. They just, you know, it's just a GPA thing. So the point was I got the bigger trophy because I was willing to protest my grade. And the best part of it all is they spelled valedictorian wrong on the trophy, which was very fitting because I wasn't a particularly efficient speller. And I the thing I'll never forget is my father looking at the trophy saying, well, this is interesting. They spelled valedictorian wrong.
All of that is true. It's beautiful. Beautiful story.
I think I might have one more photo. Let me see if I can find
Interesting enough, AJ, I threw that trophy away a long time ago, but I saved the little valedictorian spelled I-O-N on it.
Oh, yeah.
Who are these guys?
Well, yeah. This was Doug and I at my wedding.
Oh, my goodness. That's your house back there.
Yeah, this was when I got married and my best man was there. And
God, for once in my life, I looked taller. Alan's actually a good chunk taller than I am. I don't know what happened.
We're the same height.
You probably got tired of wearing your shoes. And just
you got longer monkey arms there. So that's why you look taller when we play basketball. But I think we're the same height.
Yeah.
How old were you guys in the first photo, and how old were you guys in this photo?
Well, I'm 23 here, so he's 23. Yeah. And in the first, what that would be seventh, eighth, ninth grade. So that would 14. Be what, about 14?
Yeah, about 14, 15.
Amazing. You guys have been friends almost 60 years.
God, man, it seems like 160. Oh, my God. It's actually weird looking at those photos. It's like, I can't believe it. It feels like we haven't done anything.
Wow.
Like, where did the time go? But
it has gone fairly quickly. He's still beating me every time we play basketball, which is disgusting, but I'm working hard at it 4 times a week. I'm putting about 10 hours a week in now trying to increase the skill set, but unfortunately it's hard to overcome the genetics.
Right. You guys are amazing. Well, we have a few questions if you wouldn't mind answering. There's one from a live viewer on Instagram named Diane, and she's asking, to what degree does the lack of immediate consequence to an unhealthy decision impair our ability to stay the good course of action? Great question, Diane. Thank you.
Well, it's practically checkmate. Okay. So this is what makes the pleasure trap such a problem, is that when you eat some greasy crap, you can't feel any pain in your arteries. That is the problem. So
that's why autoimmune patients often make better patients, because they get more immediate feedback. So they eat crap, they feel crappy. That's a really good thing. If you eat crap and feel great, and it takes like a week or a year or 10 years before you get the consequences, oh my gosh, try to train a dog where instead of giving them immediate consequences for behavior, wait a couple days and then give them some behavior, you know, give them the newspaper, whatever it is, and see how effective a training technique that is.
Yeah. So that is the great problem with supernormal stimuli is that it's confusing. So just to try to just say this once, because I'll say it 1,000 times between now and the time I'm dead, is that your decisions are made by very complicated unconscious cost benefit analysis. That's what makes your decisions. That's what you are. Your mind is an extraordinarily complex calculating machine, and so it's designed to be doing those calculations in the environment that it evolved in. So it has to. It's just built for it. So a rabbit is built to you know, when it looks at a fox, analyze how far away it is, analyze its movements. When a fox goes behind a tree, the rabbit doesn't forget it's there. It's got a memory system that keeps it on red alert. And it has to judge all the different options that it's going to have depending upon what the fox does. Those are all instinctual. These are all instinctual. Doesn't mean you don't. There's no calculations. It's not some automated reflex. No, these are complicated instinctual cost-benefit algorithms. It's like a business that has 17 different little software programs to analyze different aspects of its business. So if you're Walmart, you've got a just-in-time thing to figure out how to get this stuff in. Then you've got an accounting program over here. Then you've got a business management tool. You got a lot of different computers and computer systems that are doing all kinds of different aspects of that organization. That's how the brain is. The brain has all kinds of different subsystems that are analyzing different aspects of the choice that an animal is facing. The problem is that in order to get that kind of complexity, you have to evolve to be sensitive to what is the law of perspective on how far away is that fox? Is that a fox that's 2 inches high and 30 feet away? Or is it a fox that's 2 feet high and 80 feet away? Your brain has to automatically know that. You have to automatically know that a fox is dangerous if you're a rabbit. You can't learn it. It's not possible for animals to learn these things. Okay. So you don't learn that sugar is a good thing. Because if you learned, so you don't get to choose what you value. Because you can say, well, how come I can't make the choices that I want to make? Because you don't want to make them because they're not designed by nature to want those choices. If that were true, then you could just say, oh, well, I want to live in a hovel instead of a fancy house. Oh, I want to live out in the rain and it's freezing cold and sleep in the snow and my bare naked. No, you don't get to choose that. These are automated calculating systems that are designed by nature to actually have you survive in the environment that you're designed for. If you radically change aspects of that environment, very good things could happen. In other words, i.e. our nice house by the river, and very bad things could happen, i.e. heroin addiction, right, and everything in between. And so it is an enormous problem that when you taste something that is ringing the system as highly valuable because it's super normal, because it's three times the calorie density of anything you were designed to eat, that's going to be a serious problem. It's going to be an enormous deterrent to you actually getting on a healthy path. So yeah, that is pretty close to being the problem.
Yeah.
So here's a question that was written in. And the question is, Dr. Goldhammer describes women as estrogen producing, hormone producing fat storage machines when it comes to pleasure trap foods and weight. Dr. Lyle seems to describe the pleasure trap as more an equal opportunity affecting both men and women equally based on their genes and evolution. Can you please explain the difference? I love both of them.
Look, women have to be more efficient at storing fat because they have to survive pregnancy and lactation. If women were not more efficient, their survival capacity would be limited. Men don't have that disadvantage because they cannot become pregnant. They do not go through lactation. So they don't have that particular vulnerability. They may have other issues that are important, but in the case of fat storage, women are more efficient on average, everything else being equal, at storing fat than men are. and they maintain a higher percent body fat in order to be optimally healthy than men do. And so there's differences. These are biological differences. There's lots of differences between male and females, and that happens to be one of them.
All good. Yeah. In other words, certainly the everybody's eating way too many calories. So the last analysis that I've seen, it's a, you can look at an awful lot of different numbers, and it's a little tricky to triangulate on what the truth is. But it looks like the average American eats somewhere on the order of 3,500 calories a day. So that means that probably the men are eating about 4,000 calories a day and the women are eating about 3,000 calories a day. Now, we know how many calories they're burning. The women are burning about 2,000 calories a day and the men are burning about 2,500. So you can see that people are overeating by some incredible range. They're overeating by a good solid 1,000 calories a day. That is incredible, okay? And what happens is that, you know, if they stored all of that, the amount of fat storage would be insane. Everybody would be walking around 600 pounds and then they'd keel over and die, okay? But that's not what happens. The body doesn't store all of the excess calories that you eat. It only stores a portion of them. It does all kinds of compensatory mechanisms. You're pooping out fat all over the place. So people are way out of line, okay? So it's going to turn out that as Alan is saying, women start out with bodies that are supposed to be fatter than male.
Yes.
And so then you add a bunch of excess fat on top of that, and that's what you got. That's a problem.
And, you know, it is true, AJ, if you take men and put a bunch of estrogen into them, they grow breasts and get hips.
Yeah.
And if you put a bunch of testosterone into women, their fat comes off, but they get hairy and get cancer and die. So it's not a good weight loss strategy. But the point is, those differences in estrogen and testosterone are a component in the overall picture. So if both male and females are both pigging out on all kinds of concentrated foods, they're all going to get fat, but women will get slightly more fat efficiently than men will be on average.
There you go.
That's
so like everything else, women have to work a little harder to get the same results, you know? Get used to it.
Yeah. So
it's not just in weight loss, it's everything else too. So just, you know, adapt.
How do you both feel, and what are your predictions about drugs like Ozempic? What do you think is going to happen with this scenario?
Well, it's the same thing that's happened every other time they've introduced some magic potion drill. You're going to see gastroparesis. You're going to see all kinds of downstream consequences. Then there's going to be all this shock and awe. Then there's going to be a bunch of lawsuits.
Yeah. Yep. And then they'll pull it off the market. This has already been all worked out by a team of really smart mathematicians somewhere in Europe. Okay. Like, there's no way that they haven't gamed this thing out, and they know how big the lawsuits are likely to be, how much they're going to have to pay versus how much money they're going to make in the meantime. Okay. So until, you know, I mean, we're never going to fix this problem. So the pharmaceutical industry has been captured by the corporate interests. You no longer have any legitimate oversight. And so, so you don't have legitimate science being done in order to seek, quote, FDA approval. This is FDA approval has now become nothing other than a tool to keep competitors out of the game. So
it's called pay to play. And the only question is, how much percentage of the overall pie are they going to be able to take before the thing blows up? That's it.
Yeah, it's basically a Ponzi scheme. It's more or less, maybe not, but that's what it feels like. It is exactly. So, i.e., we think we're going to make about, you know, $118 billion off of this thing. We're going to have to probably shell out, you know, $18 billion of it for class action lawsuits. We're fine.
Or go ahead. Get a couple of congressmen to pass a rule exempting them from any liability like they did on some of the vaccination issues, so that the taxpayer takes the responsibility and the liability for the downstream consequences, so they'll be exempted from it.
That's exactly just how it's done. Yeah.
Nice. Let me just take a moment to thank Angela for the super chat donation. This is a sort of, I want to get back to the Ozempic, but first, this is a fun question from Randy. Do you guys have a bet going to see who's going to live longer?
No.
No.
Yeah, you've got random variation. Alan is a more fastidious liver than I am. So in theory, all things being equal, he should outlive me by a little bit. But there,
variable is the genetics, though. The bigger variable is the genetics, and it's hard to really evaluate that because that's a much bigger impact. The difference between our lifestyle is infinitesimal, not likely to have a measurable result. That piece of carrot cake you have every year hardly is going to cause you to age out. But the genetic variables, yeah, you know, that's probably going to ultimately make the difference, or it could be bad luck.
Yes.
You know, I'm more likely to piss somebody off and get taken out. So you might that's have a true. Slight edge on me there.
That's, yeah.
You know, my prediction is that Dr. Goldhammer is going to outlive both of us.
Yeah, that's a perfectly good bet, but he's accurately analyzing that random variation actually drowns out any of the differences that you're going to see in lifestyle.
Neither of us have.
I'm a better driver than he is.
I was going to say neither of us have particularly high risk-taking behavior. You're a better driver, but you drive much more.
That's correct.
And so because I don't drive very much.
Yep.
My lack of being as a focused a driver as you are puts us at a, you know, more approximated risk factor.
You got the advantage. Yep.
Yeah. You play basketball though in less restricted environments.
Yes. And
so you never know when somebody might pull a gun out and shoot you because you beat them and embarrassed them and stuff. Whereas, you know, I'm not likely to be able to do that. So, you know, your extra skill set there may put you at slightly higher risk in the wrong environment.
All right, AJ, what else we got?
Yeah, well, you know, going back to the Ozempic, you know, if people read this book, you tell them exactly what they do, right? What to do. And if they do it, it works 100% of the time, but people aren't really interested in doing this because it takes a lot longer than Ozempic.
Well, it's worse than that, AJ.
Much more difficult than Ozempic. That's the whole
point. Well, you have to go against the pleasure trap. The whole point of the pleasure trap is that it's a trap. What do we mean by a trap? Okay, a trap, the word trap is explaining that there's a cost to something that you did not see. That essentially you are being deceived by what your senses are telling you. That is what a trap is. Okay, so a trap is something that if I knew the actual situation, I would not have done it. Okay, but I didn't know the situation. I stuck my foot in a trap and now I'm in trouble. Okay, so that's what a trap is. That's why when people trap animals, they camouflage them so the animal's nervous system can't pick it up. Okay, so that's what you're seeing now is you're seeing human ingenuity. At first it was an unconscious market-driven process of just food manufacturing trying to figure out to give people what they want. Okay, and that was completely innocent. In other words, they wouldn't have known that the grease that they used to make Fritos potato chips causes some significant health problems. They had no evidence at all that any of this was there. Okay, so now they do. So now we're 75, 80 years later, and now we're 21st century, and they absolutely, believe me, PepsiCo, Frito-Lay, all these people know the whole schmo. They are not ignorant as to what's happening. They couldn't care less. They it's not their responsibility. Their responsibility is rate of return of capital to their stockholders. That's it. So now what you have is a completely and utterly unprincipled assault on the human nervous system. How can we fool it? Okay. So that's what it's going to be. And now it's Ozempic. So how we're going to fool the human nervous system into not eating as much. And we're going to do that. We don't really care what the hell the consequences are of the body, as long as we get, you know, some objective. But pleasure trap's not going away in all of its guises. I mean, one of the major chapters of the trap was the miracle and madness of modern medicine. And so Ozempic is a perfect example of the miracle and madness of modern medicine. So how can we get to the result without removing the cause? That's it. That's what an anti-inflammatory medication is. That's what aspirin is. How can we get rid of the thing that we don't want without actually removing the cause of it? That is modern medicine. Yeah, almost entirely. Not entirely. That's 95% of what modern medicine is. It's, how can we get you to not have the consequences of the self-destructive behavior that you're doing?
It's 99% of the profit of modern medicine.
Yes.
There's a big chunk of modern medicine that isn't that. They just don't make any money on that, so nobody cares.
Right.
So if people
A good example, though, AJ, is look at the definition of a great drug now is a drug that not that you take for 10 days or a week or a month, but one that you have to be on the rest of your life. And Ozempic is a good example where they'll tell you right up front, well, you'll be doing this forever because the moment you stop, or at least until the gastroparesis or the downstream consequences, you know, limit you. So they don't want a drug that you just take once. They want neuropsychiatric drugs that once they get you addicted, you have to come back forever, because that's where the real profit is. Not just, you know, the cost of getting a customer is high. You want to keep that customer. So that means you want a good act. And even the drug pushers know that. You know, the difference between recreational drugs and prescription drugs is the recreational drugs are the drugs that work well at you know, fooling the pleasure trap. Drugs that you take and don't work that well, that people don't like those. But the drugs that really bang on the pleasure trap, those are the ones that become the most successful.
And they become super profitable pharmaceuticals, i.e. opiates.
Especially if you make them illegal, where you know you have the police force basically keeping your competition out so that you can limit the supply.
Yeah, it's pretty grisly when you understand that a bunch of high IQ people are actually looking at humanity like a bunch of effectively like a bunch of mice. Okay. And they're basically we want those mice to do a bunch of work for us, and we want to scrape off, and we don't really care how it is that we do it. And we're just going to maneuver them around. This is absolutely, you know, evil. And, but it is what it is.
You've become cynical.
It's interesting. The very first pages of The Pleasure Trap, we got some help in writing the very, very first, you know, page or two, by a friend of ours, Jim Lennon. And Jim Lennon, was, I think, closer to, he's older than us. And, he was a little bit more cynical, in general about the government and the FDA and all this kind of stuff. I didn't care any about that. 25 years ago, none of that was on my radar. I was like, yeah, whatever. That's not what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about the person in front of me that can't make behavioral changes. That's what I'm thinking about. But Jim was thinking more about that. And so when he was writing a couple paragraphs for us there, he talked about how there's powerful interest in groups that are dead set against the pleasure, dead set against any essentially explanation and public education about the pleasure trap. And I remember thinking, do I really buy that argument? And I thought, well, I'd buy it a little bit. Now I buy it a lot. Okay. It is absolutely certainly they don't have to do this, but there's a very expensive conspiracy to make sure that people remain totally confused and hear good news about their bad habits all over the place. And basically the only viable solution, I mean, I have had many people call me that have said, well, my doctor's just saying it's really important for my health to get on Ozempic because, you know, obesity is such this big thing. And it's like, careful. Okay. That is not the solution to the problem. And believe me, anything that could possibly take 18 pounds off of you is a pretty damn dangerous drug. By the way, I hope I'm not wrong here because I'm being recorded, but I believe that I'm right that when I looked at the original safety data on outcomes for Ozempic, I believe the the weight loss was something on the order of about 18 pounds. So you're talking about taking people that...
You're talking about average weight loss.
Yeah, average weight loss. You're talking about people that were 215 and then they wound up 197. In other words, okay, but that's not, I don't think it's being used the way that the safety studies were doing. I think they're using higher dosages in order to get bigger weight losses out of people. So now when you do that, it's like, well, doctors got latitude because doctors prescribe and that's what doctors do. Yeah, okay. So now you slide through a flaky safety study that doesn't study long-term effects of this thing, but it's enough that you can get 18 pounds of fat loss off of people. Then we do that, but meanwhile, the doctors are immediately going to have this justification in their hands to give them bigger doses to lose 30 or 40 pounds. Nobody's even remotely touched that scientifically. So here we are off to the races with a total fiasco.
And all you have to do is cut your leg off at the hip with a chainsaw and you lose 40 pounds overnight. What's the problem?
No. What else we got, AJ?
There's a couple more questions, but do you think that people are looking for what you might call shortcuts so that they can continue indulging in the pleasure trap but still get the results that they're seeking at the same time? Is that
I don't think that they have any idea. They are completely confused and have absolutely no idea what direction to do for weight loss. It is not like they know that what they should do is get rid of the fried chicken, get rid of the beef, get rid of the oil, get rid of the butter, and get rid of the Coca-Cola. They actually don't know that. If you actually cross-examine the average person who is completely mystified, remember, the average person has an average IQ, and an average IQ is not very smart. Okay, so they're not very smart. They are completely pleasure trapped. Where are they? This is as if they know what direction to go. They have no idea what direction to go. They go to their doctor and they say, oh, I heard this weird thing that I should be eating potatoes. Oh, no, don't eat potatoes. Okay, that's what their doctor's going to say. You know, I was just reading something, I don't know, some American Academy of Nutrition. Well, we really think that the whole idea of energy imbalance is probably not the cause of the overweight problem. The weight problem is really this insulin resistance. It's like, oh, really? You guys are a bunch of paid off freaking shills is what you are. Obviously, it's an energy balance problem, for God's sakes. Any insulin resistance is the result of the fact that we've had a long-term energy imbalance and the person's walking around with 50 extra pounds on it, for God's sakes. What can you say? You sit here and you realize we will go to our graves and basically the entire world will have been completely confused.
They just released a study, 91% increased risk of cardiovascular disease associated with intermittent fasting, where they're trying to argue that people that narrow their feeding window have a higher death rate. But the study, if you look at the study, doesn't have anything to do with what people eat. In other words, we would perfectly agree the most important variable is what you eat, not necessarily when you're eating it or whatever. And the recommendations we make to people to not eat 3 hours before you go to bed has nothing to do with increasing your risk factors from heart disease. And this study doesn't suggest that it is. But they'll take that gets national publicity. And now it's a wonderful opportunity to attack the people that are recommending people try to narrow their feeding window, as some kind of secondary tool to try to reduce how much crap they're eating.
Super interesting.
That'll get great generalized publicity. And then people can go, oh, that means I need to be eating at least 16 hours a day. So that's going to solve my problems. I didn't eat enough hours of that junk. Instead of recognizing, it's all about how do you regulate what you put in your mouth.
It's actually really interesting. That I'm sure that if I were to look at that study, that study is effectively a criminal enterprise. So in other words, somebody has very selectively gone in and found something that is extremely misleading, and somebody got paid to do it. Okay. And somebody got paid to publicize this. So this didn't happen by accident. What Alan is saying must be true. In other words, and probably a lot of the people that are going to be using some kind of a gimmicky behavior pattern to try to lose weight. So they're going to be on keto and they're going to be doing a fasting window. So that's what they're reporting. Those people, not surprisingly, if you're gorging in a narrow fasting window, a bunch of fried chicken to lose weight, then no surprise that your heart attack rate went up over people that didn't bother. Okay? Because people that didn't bother were still eating some mashed potatoes as opposed to just straight steak. So anyway,
do a study and try to draw inferences where what you're eating is not a part of that parameter is obviously disingenuous.
Right.
And of course, that's exactly what goes on, though, is people, you know, they say statistics don't lie, but liars do use statistics. And there's no place that's more true in this health arena when it comes to dietary evaluations.
No. So it's, yeah.
And the problem is the media, you can have 100 studies that'll be released that show that, you know, the better you eat, the better you do. Nobody says too much, but you get one poorly done study that misrepresents the facts. Yeah. And, you know, and then people go, you know, that's what people want to hear. So that's what sure. will get sold by the media.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's not, believe me, those studies, I know exactly what Alan's saying, but I want to point out the studies aren't poorly done. They are ingeniously done. They are ingeniously done studies that are designed by nature to put something in a publication whose editorial board has been bought off so that that can be front page New York Times. This is all paid for. Okay, so what the BS that you're reading has been paid for. This is not honest science that's being done. So, yeah, of course, because why? Because the very confused person that you just talked about is trying to search for an answer to the reason that she's 50 pounds overweight. You better believe she's trying to figure that out. And so when she gets this, she eats one of two things. Absolute cacophony, whereas you can't even tell because everybody's saying something different, but there's a thread of consilience as to what it is that you hear, so that the consensus is you just better go on Ozempic. And I'm telling you,
sure you don't stop eating 3 hours before you go to sleep, because I got dozens of emails since then saying, am I at risk because I've stopped eating at 6 or 7 o'clock at night? And you know, now the study says, well, I'm going to have a 91% increase of getting a heart attack because I didn't have that late night snack.
No, break out the Cheetos. All right, AJ, let's take a couple more.
Okay, well, I'm just curious where you guys stand on this concept of fat shaming, because so many people in our community we're called fat shamers because we're even having a discussion and you can't even use words now. Like if you say obese, if you use it as an adjective, like doctors will correctly, you can't say an obese patient. You have to, you know, like everything is changing with language. You have to say a person's, they're making it like really hard to even talk about it.
Well, you know, these kinds of interesting sociological problems. I have a colleague, Dr. Jen Hawk, with her PhD in political science from Harvard. And so she's a person that is, if any of you are having struggling with this in your lives socially, you may want to get a consultation with her, because there's nobody that knows more about that stuff from the inside. You know, she was on the other side of that fence. So I call it Berkeley speak. Look, it's its own language that you have to choose the words just carefully and put them in just exactly the right order, or else you get sued by somebody. I mean, what do I think about this? I think as follows. And that is that my objective in communication is to educate and help people. And that means I do my best to try to tell the truth as clearly as I can. I'm certainly not attempting to be insensitive, but if people's feelings are hurt by what it is that I say because I didn't use Berkeley speak, I don't care. Okay, the truth is, a great deal of the reactions that come from quote transgressions of Berkeley speak are actually what's happening on the other side of that equation is people have learned that there are resources that they can get by actually making a bunch of artificial social rules that don't make any sense. And so this has been This has been slowly rolled out in academia over the last 30 years or so. And this is now a tool of various political factions for various reasons. And as far as I'm concerned, it's utterly disgusting. Okay. I never intend to actually hurt somebody's feeling. I'm not interested in how the way Alan and I talk, I mean, it's the entire pleasure trap, is basically saying, listen, if you have a problem with your weight, we're not shaming you. That isn't the issue. We're trying to educate you so that you understand the underlying cause. And once you understand the underlying cause, that is step one to correcting the problem. The problem is difficult to correct. And if you understand the underlying cause and you don't correct it, I'm still not shaming you. I'm just saying this is a problem. This is excruciatingly difficult. You know, I don't know that there's any other place other than inside the Book of the Pleasure Trap that makes such a concentrated exhortation about this is a difficult problem because the nervous system is being trapped. If you ever wanted an excuse for being obese, it's in the pleasure trap.
Yep.
It's telling you you've been duped by a pathological environment designed by nature to make you fat and sick, for God's sakes. Once you understand that's true, that isn't the solution. That's the first step. And that's all it is. The rest of it is the dogfight of your life. So anyway, that's how I look at this thing. And I'm not, but to say that it isn't, Jen Hawk had a beautiful phrase that came out of her mouth 3-4 years ago in one of these discussions. She said, it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility.
Right.
That.
And if you don't get that, you never get out of it.
Right.
And blaming doesn't get there. And a lot of people, even though they're not allowed to talk about it, they're blaming themselves. They're feeling their damaged goods. They don't understand. It's not their fault. But the only person that's ever going to help them is them.
Yes. Yeah, that's the key essential phrase. It isn't your fault, but it is your responsibility. Okay. And of course, because it's so overwhelming and confusing, people would like to offload that responsibility, blame other people, blame the things that have happened to them, blame the fact that the world is shaming them because that they have a weight problem. It's like, you know, there are unfortunate and completely unnatural consequences to following your instincts in the modern environment. That means some people, a whole hell of a lot of people, they're going to have various addictive problems, and one of them is going to result in people being obese. And there are going to be enormous psychological consequences to that. Maybe for some people, not that much, but for a lot of people, the price is going to be high. That's why, you know, Alan very carefully sat down to figure out the subtitle of The Pleasure Trap. We had the title for a while. We're already working on the book, but he was working on a subtitle that would really encapsulate the message that we were coming up with. And he did it. The hidden force that undermines health and happiness. How accurate can you possibly get? That is dead on. And that is the, you know, that is the issue. It's not just your health also, it's your happiness. In many people, the cost of the happiness is extraordinarily high.
Yep. It's true that. Thank you
so much. All right.
Got to thank Colleen for the super chat. The only other questions I see are with the T word, and I've learned not to ask you then anymore. So we're not going to go there.
Good. All right. All right, Alan, anything else? Final words?
No, you said it all.
Will there be a sequel? Oh, here's an important question. Who are you rooting for in the March Madness basketball game?
Who am I rooting for, Doug?
I'm not even paying any attention. Okay. I'm interested to watch this kid, Caitlin Clark, in the women's at University of Iowa. That girl has the Curry motion, and yep. She's dominated college basketball women. So
like the women's game now because they're actually doing a lot of the fundamentals, and it's not just size, dribble, dribble, dunk.
Yes.
They're actually playing some basketball.
They are playing very. They are actually a joy, and we're finding out that women are tremendous shooters.
Oh, yeah.
They have great technique, and you know, the women's game has arrived. It's actually quite a thing to watch.
Will there ever be a sequel to The Pleasure Trap?
There won't be a sequel. Alan has something of a sequel that's coming out. Tell him about that, Alan.
Well, we have a new book. It's coming out in June. It's called Can Fasting Save Your Life? And it takes some of the core material from The Pleasure Trap and dramatically expands it to incorporate the new research that we've done and other people have done. So Can Fasting Save Your Life is definitely an extension of the part of The Pleasure Trap that dealt with fasting.
Very good.
Right. Guys, thank you so much. Dr. Lyle, this is so funny. I have this calendar and look what the quote is for my birthday. It's one of your favorite quotes.
I can't say what it is.
Not my circus, not my monkey. That's something I hear you say all the time, and it's today on my birthday. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate this. And
great to see you, AJ.
And we'll see you sooner, but we'll also see you next year. And guys, there might be a conference coming up pretty soon, and they both might be speaking. So make sure you get on my mailing list so you can get there. And please come back tomorrow for another episode of Chef AJ Live. My guests are Dr. Jim Lewis and Karen Dugan. We're going to be talking about anti-inflammatory drugs versus turmeric. Take care, everyone. Thanks for all the great birthday wishes. Bye.